So you do need to go harder than you otherwise would if you were doing the course solo at the beginning of the race. But you don't want to go so hard that you end up blowing up and, you know, the second half of the race is just a slog to the finish line and, you know, you're crawling across the line.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast powered by Ignition Coach Co. I'm your host, Adam Samen. On this week's episode, we're talking left-right power imbalances, the basics of goal setting, and getting into some nuances of VO2 max training. Today's show is also brought to you by Flow Formulas. We're already a third of the way through 2024, which means if you haven't already dialed in your nutrition plan for the season, you'd better get on it stat. Head over to flowformulas.com today and make sure to use the discount code MATCHBOX when checking out. And as always, if you like what you hear, please share this with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if you have any questions for the show, you can drop us an email at matchboxpod@gmail.com with the email title The Matchbox Podcast, or you can head over to ignitioncoachco.com and fill out the Matchbox Podcast listener question form. All right, let's get into it. Okay, first listener question this week, we got a question from Martin in Germany. Got some questions over the pond. Hi, coaches. Huge fan from Germany, and I have two questions for you guys. First one. I use the Favero Asioma power pedals and my power output has a 52/48 right to left ratio. What do you recommend to obtain a more even pedal stroke? I think this is a good question because I get this question quite a bit as a coach with athletes that have you have to have a dual sided power meter where it actually reads the power from both sides. I know like there's certain, like I think as stages and whatever the other one, four eyes, like they try to estimate what the left to right ratio is, but it's not going to be quite as accurate as having like a dual sided power meter. But I get this question a lot where, you know, what is that threshold where you might start to get concerned with left to right power ratio? Sure. So what are you guys' thoughts on that? Is that something you pay attention to as a coach or for your own training? And at what point would you start to get concerned?
I will say that for this guy, 48-52, that's not something to even think about at all. Like, if it's consistently 48-52, stop thinking about it. It's not important. Like that's not even close to the threshold that I would be concerned about it.
Right.
And I think mine is usually 48-52, actually. So when you're going to see higher than that, like maybe 40-60 or something, I would say maybe 40-60 is the point at which I would start to be concerned, right?
Really? That's more than I would have. That's more than
Yeah, because everybody, everybody has a dominant leg. You know, it's very hard for it to be 50-50. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I would say it has to be pretty wildly off before I actually start thinking, okay, maybe I need to fix this. And if it's that far off, most likely it's because you've had an injury to one of your legs. And in that case, the solution is to rehabilitate that injury and you know, get that injury fully healed. Even when it's fully healed, there might be a power imbalance. And, you know, I don't know, maybe you could do one leg drills or stuff in the gym to try to build up the strength to the other leg. But if you're seeing a massive power imbalance, it's most likely because there was an injury. And what you need to do is fix the injury.
I went kind of down this rabbit hole a year ago because I went, I got a DEXA scan a year ago, and they had told me, and mine had always been 48-52 up to this DEXA scan. And just like you said, I hadn't really worried about it. I just figured, okay, my right leg is more dominant. And, after I got this DEXA scan, they told me that my right leg was 2 pounds heavier than my left leg, which is a pretty significant difference. So then I started riding with the left, right balance on my screen, on my computer. And I was like trying really hard to use my left leg more and more. And after about a month of that, I was like, this is silly. Like I'm putting way too much weight into this DEXA scan and into this like little bit of an imbalance. And so then I stopped doing that and I got a DEXA scan again, like 2 weeks ago, and it was totally normal. Both my legs weigh the same. So I don't know if the scan was wrong or if it worked from last year. All I know is that I went down that rabbit hole. And I think because 2 years ago I did that ultra marathon at the Mid-South and I had a bunch of IT stuff leading up to it and it was in my left leg. And so I was like, maybe I have like a a long-term injury in my left leg and I'm not even aware of it and I'm not, and I'm compensating. And I just went way too far into it. And I'm with mm-hmm. Dylan. Like if it's a 48-52, I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Yeah. Same here. My threshold that I start to look at it maybe is a little bit higher than, I guess it'd be lower discrepancy than Dylan's. I'd say once it gets beyond like 45-55, that's when I start paying attention to it. If it's one ride though, and then it goes back to normal, it's not a big deal. But if we start seeing it trending past that, and especially trending even more of a discrepancy, like that's when there might be a concern. But yeah, for the most part, it's usually only athletes that have a past or current injury that they're still mending from that I even see that much of a discrepancy.
Do you guys ever go down this rabbit hole of like the butterfly effect of like, if I hold my handlebars a little weird, then that causes my shoulders to be a little weird. And then now my hips are a little weird on the saddle. And then now I'm using my right leg more than my left, like all of it. But it all goes like back to maybe how I'm using my, or where my hands are on my handlebars. Cause I notice when I ride, my handlebars are, or my hands are in different, slightly different positions on the hoods. Like one is further up than the other. And I've like had a bunch of hand injuries where like my bones are different shapes on my two hands. So I'm like, is it because my right hand is shaped a little different? You know, like I go down these, like when you're riding your bike for as long as we are, I think about these things and I'm like, is it because I broke my hand? That's why I have like a pedal discrepancy. And I don't know. I probably just overthink it, but
no, I mean, I think your body just is going to adjust more readily than you realize. For example, so the other day I was taking some measurements because I got a new bike and I was trying to set it up exactly the same as my other bike. And I realized that one of my hoods on my gravel bike was actually rotated a centimeter forward from the other one. And I never even noticed it. And I don't know if that happened like while I was riding it, like shifted on me, or if it was from when I set it up like that in September. But for however long I've been riding with it, and I didn't even notice it. And I just like, I move around so much on the bike that it's like, you just don't, like you just get used to it. And I actually still, it's a note on my bike to like go and actually make it straight. Cause now that I know about it, I'll probably think about it a lot more. But yeah, it's just like, I don't know. For one, I never really feel like I'm super comfortable on the bike anyways. So I feel like because of that, I'm always moving around. But even when I settle into a position, like, I don't know, it's just whatever feels good. It feels fine. If my right hand's a little bit further up the hood than my left hand, as long as it feels good, I don't usually pay too much attention to it.
Do you guys think saddle height is something to talk about with this? Because I feel like the negative effects of a saddle being too high is a lot more than if your saddle is slightly too low. So like if you don't know your optimal seat height, which is obviously optimal, it would be better to be slightly lower rather than slightly higher, because as soon as you go too high, the bad things happening increases like real quick. Whereas if you're slightly low, it's not as bad. That's, I don't know what you guys think about that, but
yeah, I would agree with that. And I think like, if you look at the position of the pro road peloton these days compared to 5 or 10 years ago, across the board, I would say most saddle heights have actually come down slightly. Mm-hmm. So like your maximum knee extension at the bottom of the pedal stroke, it has decreased slightly. And I think that's part of it. I think just the biomechanics of inducing overuse injuries exponentially increases the higher your saddle height is. It just wears and tears on your posterior chain so much more. And also it'll reduce how much mobility you have as far as like getting, like bending over and getting into more aerodynamic position. So yeah, I would say I would agree with that, is, you know, being slightly lower. Obviously, yeah, you want to be in the range or ballpark of the right position, but being slightly lower is usually going to induce less injury than being too high.
The one other bike fit related factor that I want to throw out here that could be related to left-right balance is that a lot of people have a leg length discrepancy. And if you have a leg length discrepancy, that could be the cause of the imbalance, in which case you know, you should probably get that sorted out with a bike fitter and, you know, use shims or whatever to fix that. Because, you know, not only is there now an imbalance in your power, which may or may not be an issue, but I would be more concerned about potentially some sort of overuse injury from one leg extending more than the other.
Yep. Yep, I agree with that. Okay, Martin's next question says this one is for Dylan. It seems you're yearning for continuous lactate measurement. Why don't you use local oxygen devices like a MOXIE, which is a muscle oxygen monitor? I read that the local decrease of oxygen in the muscle highly correlates with the increase of lactate. A friend of mine uses it on his quadriceps for instant monitoring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of the MOXIE sensor. I haven't personally used it. Maybe I should give it a try. I don't know. That's all I'll say to that. I would totally give it a try, to be honest with you. Haven't personally used it, so don't have enough experience to say how well it works.
So do you know, like, so it's measuring just a decrease in oxygen of the muscles. So as the muscles fill more with lactate, then there's just not room for the oxygen,
or yeah,
like,
I mean,
what happens there?
Again, I'm not an expert on it, so I don't want to speak out of turn here. But yeah, essentially, and you know, there it, again, it's one of it, just like heart rate, for example. It's a proxy measurement for lactate.
Okay.
Like you can use your heart rate to kind of determine what your lactate levels are.
Sure.
I just kind of, the reason I keep harping on the continuous lactate monitor is because it would just be nice to actually measure the thing that you care about instead of a proxy for that thing.
Sure. Okay. Next question here. This is Lucy from Chicago. Lucy says, hello, I have a question about goal setting for races. I used to row in college and have been cycling pretty casually since the start of the pandemic. However, this is my first season properly training and racing. I'm 5'10", 150 pounds, and have an FTP of 230 watts. I do not really have any idea for how competitive or how these numbers correlate to a 24-year-old female, so I'm not really sure how to set goals or expectations for these races that I have coming up. For instance, I am doing a local 100-kilometer race this weekend, and I don't even know how to pace it or what sort of group that I should try to follow. Should I just look at my speed and heart rate and go on what I think I can hold for 100 kilometers? Any help would be appreciated. Love the podcast. Thanks, Lucy. So trying to understand setting expectations for herself.
Dude, Dylan, is your cat is like,
it's not my cat. It's what is it? There's a guy working on my house.
Right, oh, now. Okay. I was like, dude, your cat is spazzing out right now. Okay. Never mind.
I'm trying to help this person out by actually looking up a power chart here so that I can actually give some, you know, you can find these power charts online where it'll say if your FTP is this, you're a cat three or a cat, you know, a typical whatever. That's what I am trying to look up right now.
She said she's 24 years old. Her FTP is 230.
Yeah. At 150 pounds.
That seems pretty good.
Yeah.
For a female.
150 pounds is what, like 68 kilos?
And yeah, she's wanting to pace kilos for a 100-kilometer Fondo.
Okay, I found it. So this one has 20-minute power, not FTP, but I mean, I guess it's close enough. So did you do the watts per kilo calculation on that? 68 kilos, 230.
Yeah, 3.4.
3.4. So assuming her 20 minute is actually higher, 3.4 for 20 minutes would put her at a cat two level.
Call it 3.6 for 20 minutes.
Yeah. We're looking at between a cat two and a cat one. So she's at a pretty high level already. She's at a pretty decently high level already.
Let's go, Lucy.
Yeah.
What's up? So the fact that Lucy here, let me go back to the question. Lucy says they're doing a 100-kilometer race this weekend and they're not sure how to pace it or what sort of group she should try to follow. That makes me wonder if she's racing gravel in that case.
She said a Fondo.
I didn't say anything about a Fondo.
Never mind.
She wants to have fun though.
Oh, Fondo, you know.
Which that, I mean, that does change things a little bit because now you're, it makes it harder to understand what group to be in. Like when she mentions what group, like which group to follow, that makes it trickier because you're not just jumping into the women's Cat 4 road race or women's Cat 3 road race. And like, that's the group you follow because that's who you're racing against. Now you've got like all the women, you've got all the men trying to figure out, you know, like most of the men are probably going to go out way too hard in the beginning. So, you know, it's like, who do you follow? Like that is kind of tricky. So knowing that she has potential here to be a pretty high level female racer, maybe let's assume that she's racing gravel and I'm going to look up and see if there was a 100K gravel race in Illinois. But, what do you think, like pacing wise, how would you recommend her at least go about pacing for the first, this first, you know, first few races that she's doing?
It's always tricky. You know, we have this conversation all the time, I think, with athletes who are doing gravel stuff and it's mass start. My big thing is like experiment and figure out where your limits are. You know, like a lot of times what I'll do when I'm trying to figure out if I'm going too hard, if I should back it off or if I should try to stay with the group that I am, a lot of it has to do with like just how I'm feeling. You know, like I'm not looking at my power or my heart rate. I'm literally just thinking, I'm assessing the situation like moment by moment. And I'm like this might be a little too spicy if there's 4 more hours of racing left or 2 or 3 more hours of racing left. And if I really want to finish well for the remaining 2-3 hours, then I should probably back it off or I'm going to be totally roasted and my overall performance is going to be worse. That's obviously a part of it. But if I feel, you know, like decent, or if I think the group is going hard, but they might let up soon or something like that, then I will go a little bit harder to try to stay with the group. And really, it's just like learning as much as you can about yourself so that in future situations, you know, all right, I kind of know that if I hit this heart rate this early in the race, it's not going to be good. And I kind of know those numbers for myself. And so really, you know, think of every race as like a learning experience of, okay, I tried this and I got popped from the group and I was totally roasted and I got a worse place than I would have if I had paced myself a little smarter. Or you do the, you know, or it goes the other way where you finish and you had, you know, energy left in the tank and you're like, oh man, I should have been in a faster group at the beginning of the race. And then I could have had a better result overall. I think people just like go into races with maybe a little too much emphasis on like, this is the race that I need to do well in. And they lose sight of like the big picture of like, okay, I want to learn as much as I can so that in future races, I can keep getting better and better and better. Because yeah, these gravel races are, everyone is different. It depends on who shows up and who's pushing the pace and the course and all that, the wind, the weather, everything. So the more you can learn about yourself and those limits, I think the better you're going to be off in future races.
So let's actually give her some advice for this race though, considering that she doesn't have that experience yet. This is what I usually tell. So this is a 100-kilometer race. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's going to be, I don't know, 4 hours, maybe. I don't know what the terrain is, but a couple hours. I think that usually what I tell people about mass start races where drafting matters, it's completely different if drafting doesn't matter. If it's a mountain bike race, for example, like, I don't know, Leadville. Well, Leadville drafting matters a little bit, but I would completely change my advice for a race like that. But supposing drafting matters quite a bit during this race, you want to get with a fast group. So you don't want to just pace yourself as if it's a time trial. That's a huge mistake because you'll end up working with people that are much slower than you and probably won't be able to help you very much. So you do need to go harder than you otherwise would if you were doing the course solo at the beginning of the race, but you don't want to go so hard that you end up blowing up and, you know, the second half of the race is just a slog to the finish line and, you know, you're crawling across the line. What I usually look at is, I mean, perceived exertion is good, but I usually look at heart rate because heart rate kind of gives you a snapshot of how hard you've been going for the last, say, 5 minutes, as opposed to your power is just bouncing all over the place. And it's pretty useless to look at that. just for a second. So your heart rate kind of gives you an idea of how hard you've been working for around the last 5 minutes. And if you know what your threshold heart rate is and you're doing a race that's obviously not it's going to be less intense than a threshold effort because it's multiple hours long, then I would usually what I tell people is to know your threshold heart rate and make that like the absolute limit for the first half an hour of the race. And in fact, if you could even be a couple beats per minute below that, that's better. If you're at all going above your threshold heart rate for a race that's going to last over 4 hours, it's bad things are probably going to happen towards the end of the race.
Dude, I hit high heart rates in the first hour of the race, like well over my threshold heart rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're also experienced and have different motives. I mean, not to say that Lucy can't go into this race trying to win the women's race. Like, sounds like she's got quite a bit of potential here. But because she's inexperienced and just going there, like she just needs to build that catalog of experience to understand the racing dynamics better. It's a different scenario. Like you're going to these races because you want to get a big result.
Yeah.
So you have to push yourself. Like you have to put yourself out there. If you don't, you're going to miss the winning move anyways. And it's kind of like, okay, well, what's the point? Yeah, right. So you have to take those risks. Whereas when you're building experience, I think it is good to learn from mistakes and like, you're going to make mistakes and that's okay. So like, you have to accept like, hey, there might be a time where I go too hard or I don't eat enough or I don't drink enough. And you learn from that. That's okay. But you don't want to like intentionally go out there trying to blow yourself up. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's where Dylan's cautioning here is like set that upper threshold limit so that you can let yourself kind of get there, see what that feels like. And then maybe you feel good and it feels okay to go a few beats above that threshold, but maybe it doesn't. And you're only 20 miles into a 60 mile race that you have never ridden that long or raced that long before. And that's when it's like, okay, now I need to dial it back a little bit. I know what that felt like. I learned from that. I'm going to dial it back. This is my time. And a lot of times too, with these master races, that's why I mentioned the dynamic is different. There's going to be guys in that group that you end up falling into that are in the same boat as you, where they might've gone out way too hard to try and get in a faster group and they're going to fall off. And when you start seeing people falling off the group, if you are in that position where it's like really hard for you to hang on to that group, that's probably an appropriate time to fall off because you at least know, like you, if you're going to fall off the group, you want to try and fall off at a time where there's going to be other riders to then still ride with. You don't want to fall off at a time where you're like in, you know, quote unquote, no man's land where the group that you're with rides away from you and the group behind you is nowhere to be found. And now you're just stuck pedaling solo for a long time. So, you know, you got to kind of be strategic with that time that, and if you can't hang on until someone drops off, like that's just the way it is. But if you do start to see people drop off, that might be an appropriate time.
Also, Drew, one thing that I will say about your point of, you know, I go way over my threshold heart rate at the start of a long race is that the fitter you are, the more training history you have, the more race experience you have, the more matches you have to burn. So, you can afford to burn more matches at the start of a long race if you're fitter. If you're less fit or have less race experience, or you don't have an extensive training history, you have less matches. So if you burn all your matches in the first hour, you're screwed. Whereas you know, like you've got more matches to burn. You can go that deep at the beginning of the race and still be okay. But somebody with less training history might not, even if they have the same threshold as you.
Yeah. Matches in the matchbox. Ooh, that's really good, Dylan. I see what you did there.
Cool. So good luck, Lucy. Hopefully these first races go well for you. Let's do one more here. This is Patrick from Oregon. VO2 max intervals and different prescription for different types of riders, i.e. sprinters versus TT riders. What is your opinion about max VO2 intervals for different muscle type fiber types? For example, say Tabata style workouts for a pure sprinter, which would create way more power than a classic slow twitch athlete for each burst. Would you prescribe fewer or different intervals considering this?
Yeah, the Fast Talk podcast, they just did a full episode on VO2 intervals. And to be quite honest, before I had listened to that podcast, I had never considered Tabatas a type of VO2 workout. And I would even say I still don't really think of those as VO2 workouts. If everything over your threshold is VO2, then I guess that's VO2. But to me, VO2 is in like the three to six minute range of pretty close to all out effort, but it's a sustained, you have to pace yourself kind of effort. The way that I've always done Tabata drills has always been like a max effort for 20, 30 seconds or whatever. And that power is way different than my VO2 power when I do a VO2 workout. And those workouts are so different, like a 3 to 5 minute interval with good recovery in between versus 30-30s, like such a different workout. I was kind of like, I hadn't even considered those two things similar in all of my coaching and training up to this point. So that the whole concept of Tabatas being VO2 is a somewhat new thing for me. I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
with all
so
that,
I think but. The way I think the way to think about it is what like energy system are you trying to train versus like what power zone are you training? Yeah. Right? Because like you're saying, you know, Tabatas typically, whether you're doing 40-20s or 30-30s or 60-60s, like you're pretty much going max effort for the on portion, and then the off portion is full recovery. And but what you're doing is you're inducing a state of VO2 max throughout the extended interval.
Yeah.
So that's where you're training your VO2 max energy system just in a different fashion.
Yeah. Right.
And
right. I get that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's probably where maybe you didn't quite put those in the same category. And they're very, very different style of workouts. And anyone who's done traditional VO2 max training where you're doing full gas effort for 3 to 6 minutes versus Tabatas, like they feel very, very different. Both hurt a lot, but depending on your phenotype, like one might be easier to handle, one might be a lot harder to handle. And like, interestingly enough for me, like since I suffered from like some heart issues 3 or 4 years ago, I can't really do traditional Tabatas anymore, like 40-20s or 30-30s, anything under like 60 seconds. I can't recover from it. So like those max efforts. So if I do Tabatas these days, I have to do 60-40s or 60-60s. I can't do 30-30s anymore. Or I could, but it's not going to be as effective. I can't go max effort for 30 seconds on repeat. But I can still do like traditional VO2 max efforts very well. Like those, I can still handle those very well too. So, and they do train different things too, in a sense. I mean, you're training your VO2 max system, but, or energy system, but, with like, you know, looking at this. So, what is her name again? Patrick, wondering a TT specialist versus a sprinter here, like how would you prescribe or would you prescribe different types of VO2 max intervals? I would say yes. I don't know that I really would have a TT rider do Tabatas in a build or specialty phase leading up to a time trial. At least I'd be open to being convinced otherwise, but if I was going to lay out a training plan, the type of VO2 max intervals that I would do would be just kind of like super threshold. So not even like 3 minute VO2 max intervals. We'd be looking at more like 5 to 6 minute VO2 max intervals, just because that's going to be a lot closer to the type of effort they're going to be trying to sustain for 20 to 60 minutes. Whereas a sprinter, I'd almost think the opposite way, because you want that sprinter to have that repeatability for when they're fighting it for position. They need to jump from wheel to wheel or, be able to hang on to their lead out pace line, where the efforts might be kind of stochastic. So you kind of want that athlete to have more sharper bursts of VO2 max energy versus like a sustained effort. They're probably not, I mean, unless there's like a 5 minute climb that they need to get up and over in order to make the front group, but that's kind of different.
Yeah, I'm always split. Like what you said totally makes sense, because obviously the law of specialization would say do what the event requires. And so doing a TT would be longer efforts, right? Can you guys still hear me?
Yep.
Okay. But then when I'll pick up, there's this book, The Time Crunch Cyclist, and it has a chart. I think this is also in Training with a Power Meter, where it shows all the different energy systems and what training at each intensity zone does to each of those energy systems. And when you get into like the anaerobic Tabata style workouts, like every box is checked, and that's the only type of workout where every box gets checked. And so as far as like you're making improvements on all of your energy systems, when you train other zones, it's more of like you're training specific energy systems. But when you do Tabata style intervals, you're obviously there's like more benefit to that high power, but there's like you're training everything when you do Tabata style intervals. So like in my mind, I've always thought of Tabata intervals as like the best workout that you can do going into a race, kind of like no matter what the race is.
So to me, I kind of agree with that. To me, a Tabata workout, if you're a crit racer or a cyclocross racer or a cross country mountain bike racer, Tabata they are actually race specific and they should actually be a main part of your workout. But I still do include Tabatas for somebody who that is not the case. So a time trialist, an unbound rider, etc. And those workouts are not the focus of the training, but they're kind of the cherry on top right as the race is coming around. And part of my reasoning for that is that there was a study where they had, I believe what they had was people do race specific intervals and then just general intensity. And then they had people do race specific intervals and general intensity and race specific intervals.
Wait, can you say that again?
So
say it again, because it sounded like you said the same thing twice.
So. Yeah, no. Well, so one group is doing only race specific intervals, right?
Okay. Yep.
One group is doing, it's been a while since I've talked about this study, so I'm trying to remember it. I believe what they said was one group did race specific intervals. One group did just general intensity. So for example, if you're training for a time trial, race specific would be threshold efforts and yep. general intensity would be VO2 max efforts and Tabatas. And interestingly, what the study found was that when it came to the actual race performance, both groups performed equally. And in the conclusion of the article, they say that perhaps the best method to go about your final race preparation is to do a combination of both. Maybe that would give you the best results.
Sure.
And that's usually what I do. So let's say you have two interval sessions per week and we're in the last month before the race. So this is like the final preparation. You know, generally things need to be very race specific during this time and workouts need to be very high quality. What I usually do is have one of the intensity days be race specific and the other day be quote general intensity. So let's take this time trialist, for example. One of the days is probably going to be a threshold workout, very specific to what the person is training for. And the other day is going to be general intensity. So VO2 max or Tabatas. And for this specific person who's a time trialist, we probably wouldn't start doing Tabatas until like 3 weeks before the race, which means they're only going to do two or three Tabata workouts total. So this is not a large proportion of their total training. It's just the icing on the cake to boost their FTP ever so slightly before the race.
Sure. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think most of the research shows too that the adaptations from Tabata style workouts set in pretty quick relative to other workouts. And that's part of why they're favorable. But it's also kind of creates like an unstable bump in fitness where you can't sustain Tabata style workouts year round. And even if you, or what, you know, whenever you stop doing those basically, or, you know, you kind of like you reach the pinnacle or the peak of what you're going to get from Tabata style workouts rather quickly. So like the minimum effective dose is like low relative to other energy systems that you're working or other styles of workouts that you're doing. And I would say too, it depends. Like if someone's a time crunched athlete, like a low volume athlete, and they want to specialize in time trials, that's just like not a super common combination that you see.
It's certainly a better combination than a low volume athlete trying to do unbound,
that is true. Very true. Yeah.
You know,
time trial specialists, for whatever reason, it seems like they're usually pretty dedicated cyclists. Like they're not trying to train on 3 to 5 hours a week. Whereas like the Time Crunch cyclist book that you're referencing, like that's geared towards people who maybe have an hour to work out. Whereas like you're not going to do a high quality threshold workout in an hour most of the time. You might get 3x10, maybe 3x12, but that's about it. Where you're never going to get to that point where you're pushing 3x20 or 4x20, which if you're a high level time trialist, you're trying to get to. So that could be something to consider too in that case, depending on how much time they have.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else to add there?
No, I don't think so.
All right. We'll wrap it up there. Thanks, guys.
Cool.
All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in for the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast. Like I said at the beginning, you can send any questions or topic suggestions to matchboxpod@gmail.com with email titled The Matchbox Podcast. Links to each of our social media pages can be found in the show notes. Tune in next week for another endurance training-related discussion and learn more about how you can find that extra match for your next big event. Catch y'all soon. Let's go.
Ready to start working with a coach that'll make you faster? It's easy. Just go to the Ignition Coach Co. website and fill out our athlete form, and we'll connect you to the best suited coach for the job. You'll jump on a free consultation, determine if it's a good fit, and determine a start date. If you don't feel the vibes with that coach, well, then no sweat. We'll connect you to another coach that might be better. And then it's off to the races, or at least off to the training for the races. Don't wait any longer. Sign up today.